The past couple of weeks, we have explored distance learning from the instructors and the parents' point of view. Now it's time to hear from the students.
I was just being cautious about my health because not everybody's probably going to be wearing a mask.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear how a brother and sister are tackling the school year. We'll also have stories about music and art education and spend an academic minute playing games. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. The school year got off to a late start in Northwest Florida this year, but by late September, all public school students in the region were back in class, whether in person or via remote learning. To find out what both approaches look like from the student perspective, producer and reporter Sandra Everhart checked back with two of her young relatives on their return to school in the Escambia County School District. Back in April, they spoke about the transition from going to school every day to in-home classes. This semester, one is reporting for face-to-face instruction in class, and the other has opted to stay at home.
First, a look at the decision for each, their anxiety and preparation.
I got me a skirt, overalls. It's like white and jeans.
This is 9-year-old Shamaya, my niece, on the Sunday before, describing the outfit she chose to wear on the first day of school at Brentwood Elementary. She also got a new book bag that happens to match and some very important items to go in it.
I got some hand sanitizer, some little ones that come with some cases. I got the unicorn one, and I'm going to take 2 masks per day.
The hand sanitizer and masks are necessary because she's reporting to a traditional classroom.
Why do you think your mom is sending you to school?
Because fourth grade is kind of scary, and I might need like the teacher's help, and because she got to work and stuff.
Clearly, Shamaya understands, but justifiably, she's excited, but also a bit apprehensive about whether she's truly ready to go back to school amid COVID-19.
I kind of am, but I'm kind of scared.
Why are you scared?
Because I don't know how it is.
What do you mean?
I don't know who's going to be in my class. I don't know what's going to happen.
I thought it was the safest way for me to do school.
This is my nephew, Keandre, Shamaya's 16-year-old brother. He has chosen to start his 11th grade year at Escambia High School via remote learning at home.
I was just being cautious about my health because not everybody's probably going to be wearing a mask. And the cases are going up in this county, so that's why I did it here.
So do you have your space mapped out where you're going to sit every day?
Yeah, I'm going to sit at the kitchen table. With no TV.
During the spring, when COVID initially forced schools to close, Keandre recalls that where he worked and when was really up to him. He says it's different for the fall.
In the spring, it was more like freelance. You can control more of what you did. But now it's just going to be like straight hands-on, and you have to stay on the computer all day. Well, basically just regular school, but just on video chat.
Because he's working from home, Keandre and his mom, my sister, have put off shopping for new clothes for school. Instead, the focus has been on lunch and snacks.
That's the one thing I do miss, like getting new stuff, but I guess that's how it is this year.
Now, despite the different methods of learning chosen for them in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic, my nephew and his sister Shemaya are both prepared for their return to class.
I think it's going to be a little challenging at first. As time goes on, you're probably going to start getting the feel of it and probably start doing a little better.
After the first week of the new school year, I visited my young relatives again for an update.
I'm in fourth grade, and my teacher name is Miss Edwards.
9-year-old Shemaya is first up, sharing details about her return to Brentwood Elementary School, home of the Bear Cubs.
It was some little paws on the thing, and you got to be 6 feet from each other.
Is that on the sidewalk or on the floor?
It's everywhere.
Also, because of COVID-19, she tells me drop-off and check-in have been moved to the rear of the school.
My assistant principal, she checked my temperature. Then she told me what it was. Then I had to go to my class. And then when I came to my class, our desk is, so like that's my desk and that's somebody else's desk all the way over there.
She demonstrates with her arms stretched out across the table.
So what do you have here? What's this folder?
My take-home folder.
Let me see.
And I got my censorship and I got 100 on all days.
Shemaya agrees that the spacing between the desks is likely helping her on the citizenship front. She went on to describe having lunch at her desk, instructions to keep masks on, a limit of 2 at a time in the restroom, and she's noticed extra cleaning efforts.
Every time when we come back up in our class, you can see our playground and everything that's outside our school window. They be spraying out so much. It was... Yeah, and they spray down everything.
In the classroom, she has the usual fourth grade subjects, among them math, reading, science, social studies, and new this year is geography, which she's having trouble pronouncing. Like last year and this spring, she's doing many of her daily assignments on her Chromebook.
The first day, we were just kind of going through the motions, trying to get everybody on Google Meeting.
Keandre, the 11th grader, is now spending about 8 hours a day on his Chromebook from about 8:30 a.m. to 3 p.m.
The first couple of days, it was kind of a little bit tiring, but I started getting the hang of it.
He says staying busy helps him to stay focused.
After they told us what to do, we just went on Canvas to start our assignments. So it was really just them giving us directions and us completing it.
Keandre's classes at Escambia are on a block schedule, with some subjects on odd days and the others on even days. His studies include U.S. history, world history, algebra, sign language 2, AP English, and marine science. For this class, marine science, he opens a TED-Ed video featuring a talk by deep-sea explorer and oceanographer Robert Ballard, famous for finding the Titanic.
The first question is this. Our country has two exploration programs. One is NASA, with a mission to explore the great beyond, to explore the heavens, which we all want to go to if we're lucky. And you can see we have Sputnik and we have...
Well, we're not really learning about him. The teacher just gave us his video. To like try to inform us on ocean exploration and how it's changed over time.
The question is this.
But I haven't finished the assignment yet.
Oh, okay.
It was due Monday.
Why are we ignoring the oceans? Here's the reason.
Keandre's favorite class is personal fitness, and as a returning player, he's looking forward to the start of basketball season. Overall, he says everything is going smoothly, and with his mom, he'll reassess whether to follow his sister back to the traditional classroom after Christmas break.
That report from Sandra Everhart from WUWF Radio at the University of West Florida. It's tough to keep a band together in the best of times, but Eric Sayer is doing his best. Sayer teaches jazz performance at Minneapolis South High School. He likes to use the big band format as a teaching vehicle, but that instruction has changed a lot now that distance learning is in place. Sayer spoke with Phil Nussbaum from KBEM Radio about the challenges of teaching jazz performance in the COVID-19 era.
We had 25 students in that big band that you just heard, and it gives us a chance to learn a lot about the history of the music, a lot about improvisation, and a lot about instrumentation and blending and playing together and creating colors that we don't get to create in any other kind of group.
They're playing a piece called Sphinx's Lair right now.
The clip you're about to listen to is the first full presentation of the melody and form that students are going to get to solo over in a moment. And what's exciting to listen to is the interaction of the rhythm section with the melody. The rhythm section for us is our guitar, piano, bass, and drums, and we've also added vibes, a violin, and a viola as well. And what you can hear is they're starting from a mezzo forte moderate groove to building and filling in all of these gaps between the melody to create this really energetic and fun presentation of the piece.
Eric, I'm sure it's true with your young jazz players, just like the older ones, rehearsal is frequently its own reward. You get to play with your friends, work on music, and you get a great feeling. But I bet that's changed.
Yes, COVID-19 has certainly changed the way we run a rehearsal. I'm sure the students are thinking it's nice just not to play jazz at 7:15 in the morning anymore, which is when our two big bands rehearse at South. But obviously we're not together, and making music together is the reason that a lot of these students signed up to wake up so early. The chance to collaborate, the chance to start their day off with energy and with engagement that is fun and that is meaningful to them has been not lost, but has certainly been changed with us all going online to distance learning.
How do you do it?
The way that we are now rehearsing these pieces is we assign a chunk of the piece, and I create what is called a click track, which is just a recording of a metronome and my voice that will outline the form. So I'll share where the large rehearsal marks are, I'll share where repeats are, and they'll record their part using this click track to make sure that we're all keeping the same tempo. Then they submit those tracks to me, and I will mix those in an audio engineering software and will do my best. That's kind of the new role of the conductor these days, it seems, is to be an audio engineer for their students. And I'll mix these, and about 3 or 4 days later, I'll send the take back to them. And instead of this immediate response of when they play in class and get to hear how their sound fits in, they now have to wait several days to hear how their sound fit into the recording. And so it is certainly a different experience. I think one of the sad parts about trying to create music individually is that the energy and the emotion of the piece is really hard to feel when you're on your own and just hearing one line of the piece. Listening to one person's part is significantly different than listening to the entire group.
So the students are all recording their parts individually. How do you get them, or how do you create that feeling that they're part of a group?
I think the most important way to engage that group feeling is to make sure that you're picking a piece that the students really stand behind and value. And so this piece by Duke Ellington, Emancipation Celebration, was a piece of great importance to us as a group that we had spent a lot of time learning about its context in history and about its purpose. In many ways, this piece is social justice oriented, and it tells the story of the African-American early experience in America coming to America through slavery and then earning freedom through emancipation. And so the movement we played was obviously one of the more joyful movements, but even in Emancipation Celebration, you can hear a lot of the complexities of what emancipation truly meant to slaves at the time and what the historic significance of that act really, really meant.
Jazz education as part of distance learning is obviously working. The band sounds good. What does this mean for the future?
The work that students have been doing this last month as a part of distance learning, I think, has really grown independence in their musicianship and has taught them to rely more on their music reading skills and on their practice abilities than just the sheer joy of learning their part in rehearsal. I'm sure my students would be proud to tell you how much they all practice, but this is really thrust upon them responsibility to learn their part on their own and to spend time on their own. The future lesson that might be learned and hopefully carried into the future is the importance of independence, the importance of individual work, and what that can really add to an ensemble when you bring that back to the space. I also think that there has been a lot of learning that has happened on the educator's side of what technology exists, what resources are out there for students on the internet and in programs and applications on their phones and computers. And again, I think while some of these will never replace the ensemble experience, I think many of these are great tools that can be used as supplemental materials, that can be used as work that students do individually, and that can really enhance our ensemble experience.
Eric Sayre leads jazz performance education at Minneapolis South High School. He spoke with KBEM Radio's Phil Nussbaum. Still to come, an artist in Nashville is making a mark in his community. That story's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Marla Sivan is a young contemporary artist living and working in North Nashville. He uses painting, performance, and social practice to uplift his community. His art studio is located at the Magruder Family Resources Center, where he also runs the Magruder Social Practice Artist Residency to bridge artists with the community of North Nashville, an historic neighborhood known for civil rights advocacy and currently home to three historically black colleges and universities. As producer Melissa Sayens-Gordon explains, Marlos is providing opportunities for young people to express themselves through art, something he didn't have growing up in the Deep South.
Yes, so I call this piece Fighters. And this apartment complex is geared towards young adults who have been caught up in the justice system and homelessness. So I felt like this was a good one to put up to kind of encourage the idea of not giving up, even when it's hard. Even when you get knocked down by life and circumstances, you can get back up and keep fighting.
Marlos Ivan is a 29-year-old painter and performance artist based in North Nashville. We're standing in front of a mural he made last year in the neighborhood. His work uses community engagement to spark social change. The city's rising housing costs is motivating local artists to put up murals in the area, paying tribute to the civil rights legacy here.
So we got two fighters standing in the middle of a boxing ring, side by side with their arms up in victory. They both have halos, they're people of color. They're not facing each other because I didn't necessarily want to have them fighting each other. They're fighting other circumstances, I think.
Marlos is dressed in all black and has a cluster of red and blue dreadlocks. He reads off a quote from the bottom right corner of the mural. "Don't fight with one another, build with one another," it says. It came from a kid in the neighborhood who was watching him paint and wanted to participate. Marlos lives for these exchanges.
It's not just about me then. It's like, nah, you live here, you're around here. Contribute.
We get back on the road and head to his art studio near Jefferson Street in North Nashville.
Jefferson Street was everything, like movie theater, performance art theaters, Fisk University is there.
Jefferson is known for being a source of black culture and community organizing. In the 60s, the Interstate 40 was constructed alongside it, wiping out the once vibrant boulevard lined with blues clubs and black-owned businesses. North Nashville is home to three historically black colleges and universities, including Tennessee State University, where Oprah went.
Everything was happening there.
Marlos grew up in Goshen, Mississippi. He always liked drawing as a kid, but art was never presented as an option for him.
I never was, like, introduced to art classes. That always felt like it was, in those schools, it felt like it was reserved for other students. Like, I remember inquiring about getting in those classes and never got a straight answer. So it was like, oh, maybe I'm not allowed in there, you know? I kind of hate that I missed out on that a little bit, you know?
This meant Marlos had to find other ways to channel the creativity bottled up inside.
I always say my first mural was going into the teacher's lounge. And somewhere in the school, I found a bottle of blue gel shaving cream. And I sprayed the shaving cream all over the teacher's lounge wall. And I remember in my head, like, oh, this is art. The consequences were dire after that. It wasn't pretty.
Not having an art teacher to look up to meant he thought being an artist was not an option. And then there was being a black man growing up in the Deep South.
It's kind of scary, but imagine being a kid in elementary school singing this. Oh, I wish I was in the land of cotton. Old times there are not forgotten. Look away, look away, look away, Dixieland. In Dixieland, where I was born, early on one frosty morn. Look away, look away, look away, Dixieland. That's crazy. We used to sing that in elementary school. And I feel violated.
After high school, Marlos worked on a factory line and moved to Nashville to attend Watkins School of Art and Design. His most recent work, which he calls his most terrifying, pulls from these early years. It's a video performance work called Harpo.
Thinking back on my childhood in school and how we used to sing Dixieland and pledge allegiance to the Mississippi flag.
The film shows Marlos dancing in blackface. The song Dixie plays in the background. The song originated from the minstrel shows of the 19th century. It's considered to be the anthem of Confederacy. Marlos's art is rooted in a sense of place, now represented by a gallery in town. He had his first solo show last year. He sold half his paintings. Even with this whisper of success, Marlos emphasizes the artist's life can be a lonely one.
We're talking about nine different hustles. So being an artist is like super hard work because you're hustling constantly. You got to go out there and hunt for what you're trying to get. So there's times when I'm a teacher, there's times when I'm a lecturer, times when I'm being commissioned to do artworks.
There's also a lot of unseen labor that goes into being an artist, he says.
All the physical and emotional strain that you put through as an artist sometimes. So I would hope people that don't understand the life of an artist could be more aware of that. But the things that they don't see is the major grind and hustle.
Marlos isn't sure if he'll stay in Nashville forever. But since his practice is so rooted in the community here, leaving poses an inner conflict.
Like, I got this tattoo, time, on my hand. And time is a huge thing, you know? And I guess it's a thought, too, of, like, when will things work out the way we think they should work out? Like, one day you're like, man, I'm sick of this, you know what I mean? But the other days, you're like, I don't want to be anywhere else right now but here.
Even if Marlos relocates, his murals have left a mark in Nashville. For Transom Traveling Workshop, I'm Melissa Sines Gordon.
Game Boys and PlayStations have got nothing on board games. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Board games still have a place in our digital society. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Maurice Suckling, professor of practice, games, and simulation arts and sciences at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, details why.
Humans play games for entertainment, to pass the time, to socialize, to learn skills of strategy and organization, and to exercise their imaginations. Video games seem to get all the attention these days, but board games continue to grow and evolve. In the past decade, the board game industry has transformed into a dynamic sector valued at over $12 billion. But it's no longer limited to family game night with Risk, Monopoly, and Chutes and Ladders. Nowadays, even in the pandemic, people turn to board games to engage with and escape from the world. People are playing solo games to explore ideas, to experience stories. Board games tell stories that can change each time a game is played, although the best stories board games tell may be where the game is not really replayable, with key reversals and revelations diluted in dramatic value upon a second visit. And better than telling stories, games let us experience stories. We can lose ourselves in another world, let our minds wander, have a bit of fun. People are also playing together. They're playing in their bubbles, within families and close friends. They're playing remotely in various forms. They're playing party and social games like Codenames through Zoom. They're also playing board games digitally through Tabletop Simulator, Vassal, and other software. These aren't video games. They're board games in an online format. To understand why people seek to continue to play together, even in a time where we must remain socially distant, it's important to understand the social dimension of gameplay. Some humans crave companionship, and in board games, they find a community of people with similar passions. Board games allow us to be someone new, somewhere new. They allow us to compete, but also to cooperate. The basic human desire to imagine and create will engage board game designers and players long into the future.
That was Maurice Suckling of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. Thank you.